Thanks very much. This is joint work with Jack Porter of the University of Wisconsin. It's about impossibility results, so the talk is about nothing. So what we're interested in is understanding, there's been a lot of interest in economics about estimation inference for partially identified and moment inequality models. And it's there's been a huge amount of work in economics recently on this, and it's been known, it's kind of led to a lot of work on the technical side because there are just lots and lots of technical challenges. Among other things, we know that the inference is very complicated for these types of models because of test statistics having non-standard limit distributions. And there's emerged a very large literature proposing alternative methods for inference that, you know, in some cases have uniform validity, but it's very tricky to get that. It's also known that estimating these sorts of models, and what I'm referring to is certain types of models, a lot of these are kind of bounds models or structural models with moment inequalities that lead to partial identification. There's an inward, oftentimes an inward bias problem that can be quite severe in practice. And so some people have looked at bias reduction. So here's the bound. The bias is inward. Yeah. So that's the wrong kind of bias for bounds. So, yeah. So there's been some work on bias reduction procedures. And so there's just kind of this large amount of work kind of percolating in economics about this stuff. And so what I want to do in this talk is first start by just giving some examples of how this problem, what kinds of, some examples in economics of what people are kind of looking at. It'll kind of relate to some comments about structural models and how they are used in economics. And then I want to try to just try to understand the problem, and so in particular to isolate one, which is not the only source of the technical difficulties, which is these boundary points are determined as the min or max of certain data features. And reduce the problem to a fundamental case, a multivariate normal model with normal means, and in the fundamental case, kind of understand what the problems are and kind of what the limits are and what you can and can't do. And then what we found very useful for thinking about this problem is to kind of take that very simple kind of toy model and transfer those findings to large sample theory using the Lacombe limits of experiments approach. And I'm going to argue that these limit experiments are really a really helpful way to think about these issues, and it kind of clarifies to what extent clarifies how these problems, what the problems are, and how you should think about alternative procedures that have been proposed. Okay. So some of you in this audience are working on optimal dynamic treatment regimes, and one of the things I discovered really as a consequence of this conference was that there are a lot of these issues are very much, the issues I'm going to talk about are very, very similar to the issues that emerge in dynamic treatment regimes, and in particular some of the things that I'm going to say, Jamie said in his 2004 paper in Appendix 1. So I had a very long night on Monday night where I finally understood this. More generally, a lot of what we're saying is just trying to pull together various results that are out there in the statistics literature, in some cases rigorously, in some cases more as folk theorems, and try to pull them together to kind of understand this problem in kind of economic applications that we've seen. And I don't think, at least among econometricians, this way of thinking about it had kind of been appreciated. And so there's a lot of basically just tons of different papers proposing different alternatives, different bias correction procedures, different inference procedures, and it was very hard to kind of figure out what was going on and whether or not they're going to work or not. So in some sense, in this talk, I'm actually not going to propose any new procedure or any new bias correction or any new exact thing to do. In fact, I think that at least in this econometric literature, there are already too many proposals because I don't understand which ones are better, which ones work well, and which ones don't work well. So what I want to do is just try to understand, put them all together and kind of figure out, can they work well, or should we even try doing certain things? So, okay, so I want to start with a couple of examples, and these are examples that I'm they're not examples that I'm going to go into in much detail, and it's not the focus of the talk, but just to give you an idea of what, you know, how these situations emerge in kind of interesting economic contexts. So the first is a work by Hale and Tamer on auctions. So they were looking, so English auctions are oral ascending bid auctions. So think of like a Sotheby's kind of auction for a piece of art or something. Now, if you try to model what it goes on in an auction like that, it's extremely complicated, right? I mean, you can imagine everything that happens among all the auction participants at every second of the auction. So what they kind of suggest is, well, you know, let's just make some assumptions about behavior, but not completely specify what goes on, and kind of see what implications we can draw from hopefully reasonable assumptions about how bidders behave. So they're imagining an auction with M bidders. Each bidder draws a private valuation independently from some CDF, F. The bidders, we're going to assume that the bidders make bids. These are kind of their final bids at the end of the auction, subject to two requirements. One is that they would not bid more than what they value the object at, and the other is that a bidder would not allow an opponent to win the good at a price that she is willing to beat. So in other words, if the price is at some point and I would still like to have the good at that price, I would bid it up. So these V's are latent. We don't observe bidders' valuations. We only observe what they actually do, so the B's, the bids. And so I'll use G for the just CDF of bids. What we want to do is recover to what extent we can recover the valuation distribution. That matters a lot for thinking about how to design auctions and whether or not an auction works well in allocating the good to the right person.
I think bid means maximum bid?
Yes. So if you think of eBay, it's whatever their final bid would be. So you could imagine also using their intermediate bids as well. But yeah. Okay, so these are the only two assumptions they're making. So the model is very incomplete. They're not kind of saying, completely specifying behavior of individuals. Assumption one, however, does imply that the CDF of valuation should be less than the CDF of bids at every V value. Okay, you can actually tighten that. So that's a kind of a bound. You can tighten that by looking at the order statistic CDFs. So in particular, if you think about F sub I as being the ith order statistic CDF, there's a monotone mapping that, you know, takes any order statistic CDF and turns it into the original CDF. And so this assumption implies that if you take the CDFs, all the CDFs of the order statistics of bids, then all of these transformed versions of those should be greater than or equal to the CDF of valuations. Okay, so that's a result in Hale and Tamer.
Wait, what's I index in there?
So this is an auction with M bidders.
Oh.
So I is the bidder and then I'm using this as the order statistic in an auction with M bidders. So they get a bound, upper bound on the CDF that looks like that. And under assumption two, they get a lower bound on the CDF that involves a maximum. Okay. And if you think about replacing this, with its empirical counterpart, then you're taking a bunch of estimated CDFs and then taking the min of those, you're going to get a downward bias in that. And likewise here, you'll get an upward bias. So Hale and Tamer suggest some bias, kind of a shrinkage type bias correction for this. These types of problems also appear quite a lot in recent work on estimating models of games. So an auction is a type of game, but this is maybe a little bit more general. If you have a game theoretic model of how individuals or firms interact, and you have the game involves M agents, each agent is choosing an action from an action set, then what you might want to do is specify the payoff function for each agent, which depends on their own action and the actions of all the other players in the game, and it depends on some other things, and it has parameters in it. And so we want to estimate this payoff function, or the expected payoff function. And what Nash equilibrium says is that every player plays a best response to the actual actions of the other players. So that's that's Nash equilibrium. And so what that means is that the expected payoff under the observed actions of player I and the observed actions of every other player must be greater than the if player I had chosen a different action and all the other players had played the action they did actually play. And so this leads to a set of moment inequalities, and typically it involves some sort of max operator here. And in this case, we want to estimate these parameters theta that tell us about how the payoffs work for this game. Then the identified set would be the set of thetas that satisfy these Nash equilibrium conditions. and so there's been a huge literature kind of looking at these sorts of models under various specifications of payoffs. So these are actually two examples of what in economics are called structural models. So these are not, I think, how a lot of people here would think about structural models. In economic structural models, it's often the case that they involve some notion of equilibrium because we have players interacting with each other. And they're often somewhat incomplete, right? They don't completely say what people do. For example, Nash equilibrium, in a typical game, there may exist more than one Nash equilibrium. And you can think about which equilibrium gets chosen, but we actually find it hard to kind of have a good theory for why you would choose one equilibrium or another. So,
okay, yes,
yeah.
Expectation there is over the distribution of epsilon.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And if you had covariates or something, you would condition on those. But yeah, yeah. So these are moment inequality problems. But you can see that at the end of the day, typically what you get are things like bounds and. These sorts of bias problems also come up in a number of kind of other, cases of bounds, for example, involving treatment effects or missing data. And the bias is, you can see that if you replace these expectations with empirical counterparts, you're going to get, bias from the min and max operations. In practice, the bias can be extremely severe. So in some of these game applications, you often have many, many moment inequalities, and you can actually have a case where the intersection of the empirical counterpart of all these inequalities is empty, for example. So the bias is a real problem, and people are concerned about it. Inference is also known to be extremely difficult, and there's been a huge amount of work on developing methods of inference that kind of get the right uniformly asymptotically correct coverage. And it's very difficult. There's lots of alternative procedures floating around. And my kind of sense of the literature is that I have a hard time understanding why I should prefer one inference procedure to another. So that's kind of how we kind of came into this. And what we wanted to do was just try to think about the problem as simply as possible and see if we could get some intuition for what's going on and kind of go from there. So the simplest case we could think about that kind of reproduced the problem was a very simple model with two normal random variables. And this is very much like what Jamie does in his appendix, where he looks at a toy model. So it's really the same move. So we're looking at, imagine a single observation from a normal bivariate normal distribution with means H1 and H2. And suppose what we're interested in is estimating kappa of H, which is the min of the two means. Okay, so that's the thing we're going to be interested in. That's our way of capturing these bias problems. Okay, so we'd like to understand bias correction. So suppose that you had some estimator for this kappa of H, call it T, which is a function of the data. It turns out that there exists no unbiased estimator, and the proof is really, really simple. And so I found this useful, and it turns out to be a really old classic result in statistics. But I just want to run through it real quick because it's so simple. Suppose as a supposition that you have an unbiased estimator. So that means that the expectation under H of this estimator is equal to kappa of H for all H. So that's just the expectation of T of Z times the density of Z given H. Well, let's take the derivative of this expectation. Okay, you can easily verify that you can pass the derivative under the integral. And you take the derivative and you get this thing here. Okay, that thing is well defined. for every h. So if we assume that this thing equals kappa of h must be differentiable in h. But we know that's not true, right? Because it's a min, and the min is not differentiable when the two when h1 equals h2. So this is, you know, kind of this is, you know, this immediately tells you that there's no unbiased estimator for kappa of h, and really it's just working off the non-differentiability. So one thing that you might imagine, though, is because this function, yeah.
I used to think that was enough, but then I got into higher order use statistics. Now I claim, to me, there's not an unbiased estimator that depends on two people's observations.
That depends on two people's observations.
You're assuming that you
one. For one observation, you mean?
Because you assumed me for one observation.
Exactly.
I have n people.
Okay.
Maybe I have an unbiased estimator that depends, is a use statistic, depends on three people's
observations. Right, okay.
Anyway, the same kind of argument goes through,
right.
That you actually have to prove.
Right, okay.
So the variance only has an unbiased estimator depending on two people's
observations. Right. So what we're going to do is jump from the one observation case to the infinity case using Lacombe, but yeah. But so I don't know anything about the intermediate cases. So one thing you could imagine, though, is that you could probably get the bias really small here because this function that you're trying to estimate, you can approximate it, you know, say, by a polynomial, right? So there's a really interesting result that this is, you know, just pulling together different results out there in statistics. Das and Sethuraman show, suppose that there's a situation where you know that no unbiased estimator exists, but you have a sequence of estimators whose bias goes to zero pointwise in H, okay? Then it must be the case that that sequence has, that those estimators have variance going to infinity for every H. So it's a really neat result. It's kind of remarkable. And it kind of immediately tells you that, you know, you can do bias reduction, but you might not want to take it too far here. So that's kind of, you know, we hadn't realized this, so it was useful to know, to think about some of these bias correction procedures. And it's a really simple proof, too. It's like a three-page paper in Annals. So, equivariance. So another concept that is useful is equivariance. So suppose that your estimator, if you take your estimator and subtract off what it's supposed to estimate, that under every parameter, it has the same distribution. So that's equivariance, or translation equivariance. This is useful to look at because it's the finite sample analog of regularity of an estimator. So there's a very, to our knowledge, this we hadn't seen this proof before, but it's kind of just a simple extension of the Blumenthal-Cohen idea. So suppose that this you do have an equivariant estimator, take its characteristic function. Now look at the estimator minus the thing it's supposed to estimate. Look at its characteristic function that has to be e to the minus iu k kappa h times the characteristic function of the estimator. Since if we're assuming that this thing is equivariant, then that means that this characteristic function of the normalized estimator can't depend on h. Right? So it must be the case that there's some fixed function here that equals this. Or rearranging that this function of kappa of h must equal this ratio here. Okay, it's easy to verify that the right-hand side is differentiable. That immediately implies that kappa of h must be differentiable. But we know kappa of h is not differentiable, so there exists no translation equivariant estimator here. Okay, so we found that there are no unbiased estimators, no translation equivariant estimators, and what's really driving the results is non-differentiability. Okay. So this is, again, just like Jamie's insight. What we wanted to do next, and this is a very simple extension, but it turns out to be really kind of helpful, is to think about extending this to very, very slightly to the case where now you have multivariate single observation from a multivariate normal distribution, some mean vector h, and some known covariance matrix. We assume that kappa is non-differentiable at some point, and we allow estimators to be randomized so that they have some extra source of randomization possibly involved. Okay, so all the same results go through. It's very, very simple to extend those arguments. But this turns out to be the right kind of special case to work with. Since I'm a little short of time, I'm going to skip, but you can also say things about median unbiased estimation and confidence bounds with the same kinds of similar arguments. So there's some classic work by Fraser that shows that under some conditions on the estimator, you can't get, for example, median unbiased estimator. So.
What about confidence bounds, since I was getting?
You can get confidence bounds, but they have to have greater than beta coverage at some points in the parameter space. Yeah, so they can't be similar. Okay, so now what we want to do is kind of take this toy model and kind of turn it into asymptotic results. And so this is where the Lacombe theory is really kind of helpful, and we've just found it a really helpful way to kind of think about the problem. So suppose now you're in a parametric setting, but you have a sample size of size n, and you have some vector of parameters pi, and we're interested in a functional of the parameters, which is the min of some elements of the pi parameter. Okay. For example, it could be that the first pieces of this parameter vector tell you the means, and you're interested in the minimum of the means. So that's like a moment inequality problem. Okay. We're going to assume conventional kind of smoothness conditions on the parametric model, and then use a local parameterization where we're going to assume that all these parameters that go into the kappa function, that they're all close together, basically, or at least some subset of them are close together. Okay, and then if you think about this being a sequence of parameters, this kappa pi, the kappa function ends up just being whatever this centering point is plus 1 over root n times the min of all those local parameters. So why did we do this? We basically took the parameter space and localized it around a kind of a special point in the parameter space. For these moment inequality problems that we're interested in, that's the right localization to preserve the bias problem that we tend to see in practice. Okay, because what it means is that it's hard to know which element of that vector determines the lower bound. Okay. And so, if we didn't assume that, if they're separated, then at least in the limit, you'd know which one determines the lower bound, there'd be no problem, right? But in practice, we think this seems to happen. So we want to kind of localize it the right way. And so it preserves at least the potential for bias. It's also kind of nice because, and this is similar to the weak IV asymptotics, is that it kind of gives you back the exact theory in the normal model for some cases. Also, it's the case that if you take these local parameters and you push them far apart, you're basically back in the setting where you kind of can tell which element is determining the bound. So we think this is a pretty good way to approximate the performance of estimators asymptotically. And it's also the key localization for anything involving uniform inference. So, okay. All right. So in this setting where we're now allowed to kind of let the sample size go to infinity, we think of sequences of estimators that depend on the data up to size n. And let's suppose that we have estimators that converge at root n and have some limit distributions under every local parameter. Okay. Then in this setting, we're going to say an estimator is locally asymptotically unbiased if its limiting law has mean 0 under every h. Because we're just kind of taking the estimator minus the thing it's trying to estimate. A regular estimator, in this context, just means that the limit law doesn't depend on h. It could be normal, whatever. Okay. I think one of the really nice things about this Lacombe theory is that it lets you take that multivariate normal model and immediately say things about the asymptotic situation. So in particular, if we have a, I'm going to let J be the Fisher information for this parametric model, then the asymptotic representation theorem says that suppose you have any estimator that converges, okay, then there's some estimator in this multivariate normal simple model with one observation, okay, such that the law the limit law of the estimator you care about is equal to the law of some estimator, you know, normalized by the thing it's estimating. So put another way, anything you can do asymptotically in the original problem, you can do exactly in the simple normal model. So some of you already know this stuff, but this is not used that much in economics, and I think it's really kind of helpful. So what you can kind of think of this as the limit experiment. It tells you everything you can do asymptotically. Okay, but we already know that in this multivariate normal single observation case, you can't get unbiasedness and you can't get equivariance. And so that immediately implies that there's no locally asymptotically unbiased estimator and no regular estimator. So basically, all we have to do is think about that multivariate normal case, and then we can say things about asymptotics. Okay, and so a couple remarks about this. It applies to, you know, any kind of bias reduction procedure is just, at the end of the day, some estimator, right? Anything involving resampling or whatever. There is a very closely related result in Van der Vaart, 1991. He shows that in a semi-parametric setting, regularity of an estimator plus a mild condition implies differentiability of the functional you're trying to estimate. So I think that's what maybe you were using for your result. So we're basically, at least on the regularity issue, we're just kind of deriving the same result in a different way using limit experiments. Okay. Now this is all for parametric models. So in practice, a lot of times we don't want to assume that the distribution of the data comes from some finite dimensional class of distributions. So one thing you can do is kind of extend all this to the infinite dimensional case using tangent spaces. And so in that case, the limit experiment is going to be something like a Gaussian process on the tangent space of the model. And then you could try to work out the same types of arguments. But there's a much simpler way to kind of see that this is going to hold there. Suppose there exists an LAN parametric submodel at G naught. Right? Well, we already know in the parametric model there exists no unbiased locally unbiased estimator or regular estimator, and so you can't have it on the larger model as well. So you get that immediately from the parametric result. Okay. So at least for the purposes of these sorts of statements, you kind of immediately, you can kind of just start with the parametric model. It kind of makes it quite simple. Okay. Okay. What does this say, and kind of, you know, where can you kind of go from this? So, I mean, at least for these types of moment inequality models, it says that bias correction is kind of a tricky thing, and you might not want to push it too far. And also, since there's no possibility of a regular estimator, you can't think about optimal estimators in some of the usual ways. You can't talk about a best regular estimator or use the convolution theorem. Other concepts are still fine, and you can use the limit experiments to think about them. For example, something like local asymptotic min-max risk or local asymptotic average risk. In principle, those are still well-defined in the context of this limit experiment. However, the solutions are maybe quite different from what we usually see. So we don't know what the local asymptotic min-max estimator is here, but in principle, we could work it out. You can also just kind of take any procedure and kind of think about, its bias and mean squared error and other risk properties as they depend on the local parameter. And so one of the things that we're kind of trying to work, kind of go from here is kind of argue that it's very hard to think about, there's been so many of these different proposals for inference procedures and bias reduction procedures. At least if you're willing to live with the asymptotics, what you can do is actually just work in the limit experiment and kind of propose procedures in the limit experiment, see how they work in the limit experiment, and then typically you'll be able to find a sequence of procedures in the original problem that will match the limit experiment behavior. Okay, so that simplifies things quite a lot because these models are quite complicated. So it all amounts to finding the right limit experiment and the right representation of the functional you're trying to estimate, And then, you know, you should, or arguably, you should just work in the limit experiment and kind of think about that case. And then, you know, then you can deal with the technical details. Okay. So how am I doing on time?
You're gone a half an hour, so.
Okay, all right. So, oh, good. All right, so I'm pushing ahead. We'll be able to go skiing. So what we did was we have started just working with this limit experiment, thinking about you know, the simple normal, bivariate normal limit experiment, thinking about different procedures that are sort of, you know, maybe out there that you could imagine, and see how, you know, how they work in the limit experiment. So the kind of natural estimator for the min of H1 and H2 is just, in this case, the min of Z1 and Z2, the observations. You could imagine different types of shrinkage estimators for these problems, so like a hard thresholding estimator where you kind of take the average of Z1 and Z2 if they're close together and take the min if they're very far apart. Right? So remember, we're trying to find the smaller of the two, but if they're close together, we think that, you know, we have a chance of being biased, so then we're going to average the two. Okay. There's also shrinkage. You could also imagine shrinkage type estimators. And in the Hale-Tamer work, they suggest a shrinkage type estimator, the kind of more soft thresholding type estimator that ends up having something like this form. So it ends up being a kind of weighted average where the weights depend on how far apart the original estimates are. Okay. You could also imagine trying to do bootstrap bias correction here. And in the limit experiment, it's very easy to kind of work out what the bootstrap bias correction looks like. Mm-hmm. It turns out, you know, there's a bias function for the min estimator. And so in the bootstrap bias correction, you would take the min estimator and then subtract off the bias function evaluated at your estimate of what the parameters are. So that's this T1z minus B of z. Okay. And you can also work out, for example, the Bayes estimator in this limit experiment, with the idea that typically, you know, Bayes estimators in the original problem look like flat prior Bayes in the limit experiment under some conditions. So a flat prior Bayes estimator, if you just work it out, it turns out it's kind of very curious. It's the min estimator plus the bias rather than the min estimator minus the bias. It's very odd, but that's just how it works out. So it's kind of curious to us. So you're going to expect that this would have a lot of bias. Okay, here we go. All right, so here's just some simple bias curves. We set the first parameter equal to 0 and looked at positive values of the second. And remember, we're trying to estimate the min of these two. And so the bias curves look like this. The dark line is the original simple kind of analog estimator. And then see that these shrinkage type estimators do reduce the bias a little bit, but you still have quite a bit of bias here. And bootstrap bias correction also is somewhere up here, so it looks similar to a hard thresholding type estimator. And then this is the Bayes estimator here, this dotted red line, so it's got more bias. So what's going on with the Bayes? Well, of course, the whole point of Bayes is to get average risk optimality, right? So, and in this case, it's the posterior mean, so it's average mean squared error risk. So what the Bayes estimator is doing here is it's trading off a little bit of bias, or some, actually a lot of bias, to get the mean squared error quite low over a lot of the parameter space. So that's what's going on here. And so for a lot of the parameter space, it does much better in terms of mean squared error, but then you pay a price over a little piece of the parameter space. But that also lets you think about alternative ways to weight the parameter space and define the Bayes estimator for that, and then kind of see what kinds of trade-offs you'd be willing to make there. Okay. Yeah?
So what's the minimax estimate?
I don't know yet. It's hard, right? I mean, in the we're working on it, but in the simple case, it's easy to solve, right, by the Hund-Stein theorem or whatever. But here, I mean, there's no estimator that's going to have constant risk, so it's very hard to solve for that. So,
I mean, this simple case, to me, when there isn't this weirdness.
Yeah, when it's just differentiable. Yeah. So usually flat prior Bayes is min max, but.
So Larry Brown and gang have never done this minimum of two normal means, or.
So I know that Blumenthal and Cohen worked on this back in the 60s, and I don't think they were able to get the min max estimator for that. I might be wrong. I should go back and look, but it, in principle, you could solve it numerically, but it would just. And you may not like the min-max estimator here. Yeah. So, So to kind of conclude, the limits of experiments. What we like about it is it lets us turn this problem, which if you see this kind of literature that exists in this moment inequality stuff, it's just very hard to. I mean, it's just really dense, and so it kind of lets us simplify the problem to the maximal extent possible. So, and especially in these non-standard problems, we think there's a lot of gain to doing that. It's also been used, for example, in understanding things like the unit root problem in time series, weak IVs, and things like that. So it's a very helpful way to kind of simplify the problem. And I think where we're trying to move is to use this to help us suggest alternative procedures and kind of understand the trade-offs better. But there's lots more to do.